This is the session on The Body of Christ Has AIDS, the Second Decade. My name is Mary Carlson. This is my second week on teaching staff here this year. I've been here other years speaking on other topics also. I currently teach social work at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And prior to my teaching experience there, I was a medical social worker for 12 years. The previous years to St. Olaf, immediately prior to St. Olaf, I was working with people with HIV and AIDS. So I've kept that up as both a clinical interest and a personal interest for teaching and in my own life. And I'm pleased to be able to spend some time this week talking about it. In front of you are a number of handouts that I brought along, sort of for informational purposes. There are three piles of handouts that have some statistics about HIV and AIDS in the United States and in the world. And this small handout over here, it has the ELCA statement on HIV and AIDS. If any of you are interested, please feel free to take that, and I'll be handing them out through the week, too. Let me also just mention some books in the bookstore related to the topic that I would certainly suggest people think about buying. Go Toward the Light is a story of a young boy with AIDS written by his mother. Very powerful, very moving story. I'm going to talk about children and women with AIDS and HIV tomorrow. But it's a terrific book. I started crying, I think, on the third page, and I don't know that I stopped before I put it down. Letty Russell from Yale University has edited a book on the church and AIDS, coming out of discussions of the Commission for Faith and Order for the National Council of Churches. It's also a very helpful book. The AIDS Reader looks sort of intimidating, but it isn't. It really talks about AIDS from social, political, and ethical issues. In a lot of its facets, and it's an easily read book. I use it in my class. I teach a class on HIV and AIDS, and college students can get through it. I think most of us can probably grasp it. And the last is AIDS, Personal Stories in Pastoral Perspective, written by a couple of ministers about their experience in ministering people with HIV and AIDS. So also powerful, moving testimonies, personal testimonies. I'm a fairly informal presenter, and I encourage interruptions whenever something isn't clear or you have a comment or question. Please feel free to ask. And before I get started, really, I'd like to know a little bit about who you are. First off is how many of you have had HIV or AIDS education somewhere, somehow? What was the format? Was it church or business, work, schooling?
Work.
Work, okay. Work also. Okay. Church and school. Good. How many of you work with HIV and AIDS? So like nurses here, doctors? Okay. Good. And how many know somebody with HIV or AIDS or have known of somebody? Okay. Significant number. Good. That's increasing all the time as I do public conversation about HIV and AIDS. More and more people are raising the hand on the last question. It does talk to me about how important it is that we talk about this particular subject. Okay, let me start out by reading just a paragraph from the ELCA statement on AIDS. It's called AIDS and the Church's Ministry of Caring, just to sort of set the context for our discussion today and for beginning the week. This was written in 1988. The Church's Ministry of Caring is a grateful response to God's caring for us. The undeserved love of God announced for all in the gospel of Jesus Christ is our reason for standing with our neighbor in need. Jesus responded graciously to persons who were sick without assessing their merit. In the same way, we are called to, quote, be Christ's for all in our midst who suffer and are ill. Our calling summons us to compassion for, acceptance of, and service with people affected by AIDS, both within and outside our congregation. Can notice a couple of the buttons I'm wearing. One says our church has AIDS. It's from the National Episcopal Church. And the other one says the body of Christ has AIDS. Reminders that it really is in and among all of us and not affecting only specific groups of people. Okay, what I'd like to do today is spend a little time on AIDS and HIV in general. We've entered the second decade of the epidemic, at least as it is known to us as human beings and has been named, to sort of see where we are with it and where we're going. My attempt is to talk somewhat about the whole globe, and that's difficult to do in an hour, but I'd like to at least touch on some of the important ideas and facts and trends about HIV and AIDS. during the week, should some of you choose to come back, I'm going to focus on the effects of HIV and AIDS in particular communities of people, women and children, adolescents, communities of color, and the gay community in our country. So those will focus more on sort of psychological, social, emotional, spiritual effects on those communities. Today we'll do a little more statistical stuff than I usually do, although I'll try to keep that fairly brief. What I'd like to do first is have each of you turn to a neighbor, whether you know the neighbor or not, ideally maybe somebody you don't know, and spend about 5 minutes, you don't have to do any writing, but just go through these questions quickly to check your own knowledge with each other, and then we're going to use these questions as some of the outline for the initial part of what we talk about. I'd like to give you about 5 minutes to just test your own information and knowledge. Would you do that? Pair up in little pairs. Anybody upstairs for you?
Oh, I'll just kind of go.
You think of it in your brain. Okay. And then we'll come back together in about 5 minutes. Okay, why don't we pull back together here in the larger group? Appreciate your spending a little time. You also get to know some of your neighbors who might be in the village for the next few days, which is kind of fun. Let's start out with what HIV is. Somebody tell me. HIV stands for Human Immunodeficiency Virus. That means it is a human virus, not an animal virus, though there are similar viruses to HIV found in animals, particularly the SIV, which is the simian immunodeficiency virus in monkeys. Immunodeficiency refers to what?
Immune system.
Okay, your immune system isn't working very well, indeed. It makes you tend to get certain infections and cancers and other things that most of us can fight off with healthy immune systems. Virus is that it's a virus, it's not a bacteria, it's not a another sort of germ. Generally speaking, HIV is a pretty wimpy virus, meaning it dies when exposed to air, when exposed to bleach, when exposed to heat. However, as we've heard in the last couple of weeks after the 8th International Conference in Amsterdam, it's also a very tricky and changeable virus. There's some assumption that the virus mutates fairly quickly, adapts quickly to efforts to kill it or hit it with a vaccine of some sort. We'll come to that in a little bit. Okay, HIV is believed by 99.9% of the scientific and medical community in the world to cause full-blown AIDS. I say that because there still are some doubters that say HIV is not the cause of AIDS or may not be the sole cause of AIDS. I think it's important to say that, although the bulk of the experts in the world believe that HIV causes AIDS. AIDS is what? Stands for? Acquired Immunodeficiency Syndrome. It's important to say acquired. It means you get it from someone. It doesn't just pop up in the body, right? Immunodeficiency, same as in HIV. And syndrome, what's important about that is AIDS is not a disease. AIDS is a number of diseases that make up a syndrome. We'll talk a little about how it's diagnosed. So it could be all sorts of different diseases, among them toxoplasmosis, cryptosporidium, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, lots of sort of strange sounding diseases. But it is a syndrome of diseases, which I think is important for us to know. I saw a hand back here. You, okay, good. 1987, the World Health Assembly was meeting and they defined HIV in itself as a naturally occurring retrovirus of undetermined geographical origin. I bring that up because inevitably somebody says, well, where did HIV come from? Generally speaking, there is not agreement in the scientific community across the world where it came from. I'm of the mind of Kenneth Kaunda, who is the former president of Zambia, I believe, whose son died of AIDS and who was one of the first African leaders to acknowledge the extent of AIDS in his own country, who said, it is not so important to know where this virus is where this virus came from, but where it is going. Generally, that's my perspective. Also, we can talk individually if people want to know some of the theories about where it came from, but I don't usually like to spend lots of time because we don't know. People are looking into where it came from. There are two kinds of HIV virus, at least, that are known to us now. HIV-1 is the most common. That's the virus that's found in most of the United States, Western Europe, Africa, Latin America, Asia. HIV-2 was found in Western Africa, three or four different countries on the Western African coast in 1985. It stayed primarily within that community. If it's found elsewhere in the world, it's usually West African people who have come to parts of the world where they're found to have HIV, or people who have visited those countries in West Africa are found to have it. Generally, it causes the same kind of problems with AIDS as HIV-1, but it seems to maybe work a little more slowly, and so that people are looking at that and trying to figure out why that might be. Okay, AIDS in itself, full-blown AIDS, I mentioned, is a spectrum or is a syndrome of illnesses. There are at least 15 illnesses that can give a person an AIDS diagnosis. In 1987, the definition of AIDS was expanded to include encephalopathy, which is an infection in the brain, right? Because HIV is found not only to infect the white blood cells in the immune system, but can be directly found in the cerebral spinal fluid and affect the brain. And also what's called HIV wasting syndrome, which is the loss of body weight, which is primarily what we see in a lot of developing world nations, probably for reasons of underlying malnutrition already. That means people who have lost around 30% of their body weight and have HIV can be classified as having full-blown AIDS. What's important about those first two questions is to know that people who have HIV do not necessarily have AIDS. And I know it's helpful to remind us all, most of us do know that. Experts say there can be anywhere from 4 to 10 times the number of people with HIV as the number of people with AIDS. So as you see statistics about numbers of people with full-blown AIDS, think 4 to 10 times that are probably infected with HIV worldwide, although it's really hard to know those numbers. I didn't leave myself enough blackboard space. It's also, I think, critical to talk not so much in terms of AIDS as a disease anymore, but a lot of physicians and other healthcare workers are moving to what's called a spectrum of AIDS illness. Essentially, lots of you saw the pyramid. At some point, the pyramid diagram that said AIDS is at the top, it's just the tip of the iceberg or the tip of the pyramid, and as we come down, people at the bottom are those who are HIV infected. More people now are thinking in terms of a continuum along one line, from this end being people who are just infected with HIV. Some of those folks have, within about 2 weeks of infection, a flu-like illness, maybe a sore throat, maybe some fatigue, some diarrhea, and that goes away. And then for a long time, they can feel just fine. That's called asymptomatic, without symptoms. That can be anywhere from 8 to 10 years in a Western world country where we have fairly good health care, fairly good nutrition. People can live up to 10 years, perhaps longer, once we sort of have the epidemic around for a longer period of time. Then comes sort of the third stage of HIV illness, which is symptomatic, which means people who have the virus and start experiencing some symptoms again, maybe a chronic cough, some diarrhea, weight loss, general fatigue, night sweats, things that how many of you have had in the last year? I point that out because people who are symptomatic don't necessarily know that they may be symptomatic with HIV, because it's hard to know that that's the underlying cause of these symptoms. They're very common symptoms. Then we get to full-blown AIDS, which is sort of the fourth area along the spectrum, if you will. That is, people who have HIV, have had symptoms, and now are diagnosed with one of the infections or cancers that fit into the listing of AIDS diseases. Does that make sense? Sort of think about it along that spectrum. Okay, let's go on to how HIV/AIDS is diagnosed.
Antibody.
Okay, say more. Antibody testing. Okay, what does that mean?
Well, I guess when a person has been supposedly infected, there's a reaction by the body and develops these antibodies to this disease.
That's right.
If you do have been infected by this person, you're going to have this antibody to the disease.
Okay. And the reason that's important is that we currently do not have in widespread public use at a cheap cost an antigen test. In other words, we can't test for the virus itself. We can't test for the virus in the blood. We test for these antibodies that our body has developed in defense against HIV.
They test them at, say, right away. They test them at 3 months and 6 months because they might not show right away.
That's right. That's the exact point. That's why people who worry, last night I had sort of an unfortunate one-night stand, or women who have been raped perhaps and are worried they want to test the next day to know if they're okay, the next day won't do it. People develop these antibodies at different rates, some as early as 2 weeks, the average person more like 3 to 6 months, and one woman in the United States was found to not have developed them for 2 years. So that's fairly unusual. But 3 to 6 months is the average period of time that the average person develops antibodies to this virus. Now, there are some antigen tests that are being worked on and developed, but currently they're fairly expensive. And when they're used, it's often in big university hospital settings or research settings on babies, because we're trying to know earlier if babies are HIV infected directly or if they're just carrying mom's antibodies to HIV, which usually stay in a baby's body 12 to 15, even maybe 18 months. So it's hard to know whether a child is infected for almost a year and a half of life without the antigen test. It's also important because of testing our blood. In this country, we've tested blood, donated blood for HIV since 1985. But again, they do wait some period of time, but it may be that some blood gets through that has not had the antibodies yet developed. That's why the blood supply in the United States is virtually 100% safe, but virtually means that there is this window until we have an antigen test. It's also critical in developing world nations where they don't have the money by any means to test all the blood. So there still is a vast potential in those countries for transfusion-related HIV. Okay, AIDS is diagnosed, as I mentioned, with having a positive HIV test, antibody test, and having one of the opportunistic infections or cancers or this wasting syndrome that goes with AIDS.
Yeah. Doing an antibody test is a common way of detecting other diseases as well, so that leaves you a lot of room for misdiagnosis.
Yeah, except I understand that this HIV antibody is a particular antibody only to HIV. So you wouldn't misdiagnose for other viruses. Is that accurate from what people are aware of?
Monoclonal testing for that specific.
Monoclonal, that's the word, and I never quite knew what that meant. But that specific antibody.
It's just basic.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Okay, I talked about the incubation period. It's important to say that people often live 8 to 10 years with HIV, asymptomatic, that is without symptoms. But we're talking about the average American person. And in those statistics, that's the average white American male who's diagnosed with HIV. It's important to know that women do not live as long with HIV before coming down with AIDS. Children come down with AIDS, full-blown AIDS, faster than women or men. And people in developing world nations come down very quickly, often, with AIDS, and we can talk about some of the reasons for that over time. The average time period from knowing you're HIV positive or being infected with HIV and moving to full-blown AIDS is about 18 months to 2 years in this country. But the average African-American woman who's diagnosed with HIV gets AIDS in about 7 months. So there are some real socioeconomic, gender, racial differences, and I urge us always to listen to statistics with caution, because most of our statistics in the U.S. thus far have been based on the gay, white, male population here, and we'll talk about some of why that is. Important to remember, however. Okay, how is HIV transmitted? Three primary ways, one not so primary in the United States. What are the three major ways? That's the fourth one. Okay, that's good. That's at the bottom now because of the blood testing. However, sexually transmitted. We'll come back to that. Blood transfusions can be a common problem in other countries that don't test their blood at this point and aren't able to use sterile, clean needles each time a transfusion is given. Some countries must reuse needles because of a lack of needles or a lack of ability to sanitize or sterilize those needles. Is there a question here?
No,
okay.
I was just scratching my head.
See, I'm so tuned into people's needs for questions. Okay, then you said sexual
transmission.
Talk about that. What does sexual transmission mean?
Contact with sexual fluids.
Okay. Of somebody who is HIV positive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because after one talk I did, I had a gay male couple come up to me and say, "You mean if we have contact with each other's fluids, we could get HIV?" And I said, "Well, only if one of you is positive." And I guess I have to make that real clear over and over to us. It is sexual contact with somebody who is HIV positive. That means exchanging bodily fluids, primarily blood, semen, and vaginal fluids. Now, those are the three fluids that have the highest level of HIV present in the fluids. HIV has been found in tears, saliva, urine, pleural fluid, but we have no known cases at this point of transmission via any of those fluids. People are able to trace back that there was probably exchange of those more highly infectious fluids. Okay, sexual transmission is the most common route of transmission in this country and in the world. And that is sex between men, sex between women on occasion. Lesbian women have been known to pass the virus to each other, though extremely rare. Sex from male to female and from female to male. You need to know it's probably around 10 times more likely for men to give the virus to women than for women to give it to men. Why is that? Okay, there's some protection in that primarily it's more difficult. Well, in general heterosexual intercourse, it's very common for women to have small tears and abrasions in the vagina, and that allows for blood and semen to be interacting much more easily than for men to have any cuts or tears on the penis. That's the assumption about why it's easier for men. Also, semen is so highly infectious and obviously, good amounts of semen are put into a woman in the time of intercourse. So I bring that up partly because historically, and now even around the world, often women are viewed as the sources and causes of infections, lots of sexually transmitted diseases. We think about prostitution, we think about, you know, the dirty woman, the person who's unclean. That holds true in a number of cultures, including our own. So it's important to know that it's harder for a woman to give it to a man, though it certainly can happen. Yeah?
Okay, then are you saying it has to enter the bloodstream?
Yeah, it really has to enter the bloodstream. Yes.
Into the body.
Because stomach acid kills the virus. So really the bloodstream is the key place. Other questions at this point? Okay, sexual transmission. What's the second highest way to transmit the virus? Okay, IV drugs. What do you mean IV drugs? Take IV drugs, you get HIV?
Share a needle.
Share a needle with someone who has HIV. Thank you very much. Not to say go ahead and share needles if people don't have HIV, but it is to say it has to be shared needles with somebody who is HIV infected. This is getting to be increasingly common in the United States. It is where one of our new epidemics, if you will, is sort of coming up and increasing, and that is among IV drug users. It's also not unheard of in other countries where certain ritual rites of passage may involve needle use for various things to pass the virus that way. But anytime, again, blood is mixing with blood, you have potential for the HIV to pass. When I teach this to the college students and to adolescents, I generally try to ask whether people can describe what happens in sharing needles, because we assume that a lot of us know, and most of us don't use IV drugs, but what happens is one user shoots up the drug into the vein, has to pull back a little bit to make sure the vein is hit before really shooting up. Then when he pulls out or she pulls out of the vein and gives the needle to the next person, there's often a little bit of blood left, which is still inside the needle and the syringe, and that is then injected into the next person. We have seen some helpful results in IV drug using communities when people are instructed on how to clean their needles and their works with bleach and not share those, but we'll save that too. I'm going to talk about IV drug users later in the week. Okay, third most common route of transmission in this country? Mother to baby. Yeah, maternal to child transmission. That happens either in utero or during the birth process, or there have been some documented cases of breastfeeding with mother passing the virus to the baby. Very few, but from some other countries, not in the U.S. at this point. That is increasing in number in the United States, mother to child transmission. That's partly because more and more women are getting HIV in the United States. It is a very common route of transmission in other countries. In Africa, the rate is 1 to 1, male, female, who have HIV. In this country, it's approximately 10 to 1. There are 10 times more men who have HIV in the United States than women. So we're not seeing as many babies, although that number is also increasing. And I'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow. So those are the four primary ways, and then the transfusions being the fourth one at the bottom.
Mary?
Yeah?
I suppose in terms of the mothers that do transmit the virus, do they fall more predominantly into any of the other categories? Are they primarily IV drug using mothers?
They are primarily IV drug users themselves or partners, sexual partners of IV drug users. And actually, the sexual partners of the IV drug users is the highest, the fastest increasing number of women. Yeah, so that's a good point.
One issue that's gotten a lot of press is contagiousness to or from healthcare workers.
It's gotten a lot of press. You see a little picture here, doctors with AIDS, front of Newsweek magazine, one of our doctors in Minneapolis, near where I'm from. Come to this, who has AIDS? This other category in the United States, 4% of people. That includes healthcare workers, and it includes all the people for whom we don't know how they got it. We don't know what their transmission was. They either died before we could find out, or they refused to answer questions, or was too difficult to tell because of multiple risk factors. That's sort of, to put it in perspective, it's a reasonable fear. It's a reasonable fear in this country. If you talk to healthcare workers and actually read some of the studies, it's even a bigger fear for healthcare workers who may get infected from their patients, because the rate of infection in the general population is much higher, and it's unknown to many of those healthcare workers. Now, the raging debate is whether healthcare workers need to or must ethically tell their patients they have HIV, and we can sure come back to that. Dan and I did a whole series on ethics last week. We could have used that as a case study. But that's a good one. It's a very big debate, and there aren't answers out as of yet, although different states have, I think, come up with some of their different recommendations about that. Okay, as we talk about transmission, let me go through one other thing, which is the notion of cofactors. Is that something people have heard a little bit about, cofactors in transmission? It's getting a lot of attention by researchers right now who are assuming or trying to figure out why some people are more likely to get HIV, maybe with one example of risky behavior, a one-night stand or a rape or one time having sex with a partner who then finds out he or she is HIV and you only had sex once, or one IV drug use time and you get it. Why do some people get it immediately and some people, say, hemophiliac couples where the male has hemophilia and was HIV positive because of some of the blood products he received. And he and his wife for years didn't know it and went ahead with normal sexual relationship and she doesn't have it. We don't know why that is yet. Some of the cofactors that are being looked at are the presence of other sexually transmitted diseases, particularly some STDs that involve open sores, genital sores, that might allow for the virus to enter the bloodstream more easily. This is very common in a number of developing world countries, poor communities where healthcare is difficult to come by. Presence of malnutrition or malnourishment underneath may be a cofactor. People might get HIV easier if they're not well nourished. Certainly alcohol use might be a cofactor. Why is that?
Stimulates the blood circulation.
Well, it actually depresses the immune system. Yeah. Alcohol use can depress the immune system function biologically. And there's also the psychological social function of reducing our inhibitions, right? Allowing us perhaps to engage in more risky behavior than we might otherwise engage in, forgetting the condom or forgetting how to use it or having sex with somebody we just met. Maybe we wouldn't do that if we hadn't been using alcohol. So both some biological and some psychological social reasons for that. Other cofactors are looking at the presence of TB. We're seeing a huge increase in the cases of TB in this country and around the world as AIDS is increasing, and researchers are trying to figure out what the connection between the two might be. Some countries are beginning to look at whether uncircumcised males are at higher risk for getting HIV more easily or progressing faster to AIDS because of the possibility of more infection in a male who's uncircumcised. Now again, that's where research is looking. We don't know that for sure. And we haven't seen that issue in this country. I think generally it probably has to do with poor conditions and sanitation that's maybe not as likely to be good because of general socioeconomic factors. The other probable cofactor is repeated exposure to HIV. And this is important for couples where one or both partners are HIV positive, particularly when both partners are. It may be that, you know, it used to be they said, well, great, then we don't have to worry. We can go ahead with unprotected sex and not worry. It may be that they have to worry because repeated exposure to HIV from someone else may make you progress faster to AIDS. So those are the kind of cofactors people are looking at and trying to figure out. Okay, who has HIV/AIDS? How'd you answer that one? Besides the body of Christ, that's the title of the talk. How did you answer who has it? If somebody says to you, well, who has this virus? Anybody? The community? Any one of us? Could? Okay, good. Well, let's just look. In the United States right now, Africa has about 69% of the cases of AIDS. Now, these are both AIDS, because that's the only statistics we have. The United States has 16%, Europe another 6%, the Americas, meaning Latin America and Canada, non-US, another 9%, other, that means Asia, Southeast Asia, etc. Now, this is the known cases of AIDS. What's the problem with looking at this?
The iceberg.
Okay, the iceberg effect. We don't know how many people are accurately telling us what they have. Now, this is the World Health Organization statistics. They have about 180 countries reporting to WHO. Anybody know how many countries there are in the world as of today?
No.
You tell me. I have no idea, but it's over 230. I know that because there were at least that many about a year ago, and we've added lots of former Soviet Union countries, etc. The point is that a lot of countries don't report their statistics on AIDS. A lot of countries underreport. A lot of countries don't have the capacity to know if people have AIDS because they don't even have the blood test. Some of the WHO statistics haven't been updated since December of 90 for some countries. So I urge you to really look at this with caution, primarily because Latin America, countries like Brazil especially, have dramatically increasing epidemics, dramatically increasing. And Asia and Southeast Asia, 3-4 years ago, we're sort of saying, well, it's kind of a safe part of the world. Thailand, India, the Philippines have tremendous numbers of people with HIV now and AIDS. So in another 2 years, if I come back and teach, or if you go read something about it, you'll see this pie change dramatically. Now we hear about Africa because a number of those leaders fairly quickly said, yes, we have an issue here, and there has been some effort to really work in Africa and look at those statistics. In the United States, who has it? 58% of the people with AIDS, again, not HIV, AIDS, are homosexual or gay men. This, when I started teaching AIDS about 5-6 years ago, was more like 75-78%. It's important to say that a place like Minnesota, it's still around 91%. So it really depends on where you are in the country. You live in Newark, New Jersey, it's not going to look like this pie. You live in Minnesota, Minneapolis, it's not going to look like this pie. This is the United States, okay? Homosexual males, 58%, slightly over half. Sort of flies in the face of our assumptions about AIDS, I think. IBDU is intravenous drug user, another nearly quarter, 23%. Sorry, it's hard to see this, a little hard. People who got AIDS by heterosexual sex solely without other risk factors, about 6%. That's gone up. I started teaching, it was about 4%. But not gone up as fast as a lot of people have, you know, led everybody to believe, oh, it's exploding in the heterosexual population. But it is growing. People who are homosexual men and IV drug users, so they didn't know which it was, is about 6%. Transfusion-related AIDS, 2%. Hemophiliacs with AIDS, 1%. What's real important to say about this, however, is though hemophiliacs are only 1% of the people with AIDS, the hemophiliac population itself has been devastated by this virus. I don't know a lot about hemophilia. Some of you may know more, but there are gradations of severity of hemophilia. Those who have the most severe kind of hemophilia are found to be 90% HIV positive. 90% of those men. It's like 99% men with hemophilia. And that's because over the years they have received more and more clotting factor they need for their blood to clot. And the more severe they are, the more they need, the more their risk. It's awful.
And clotting factor is made from the accumulation of other people.
Of lots of other people,
right,
to get one.
And so we're talking major numbers, amounts of other humans,
yeah,
blood to make the clotting factor.
That's right. Since 85, that clotting factor has been heat treated, I understand. And so the risk, again, is like it is with transfusions. It's they're tiny because of our possibility of missing some or not treating enough, heat treating it enough. But generally speaking, it's now not so risky to have hemophilia, thank goodness. But the dramatic effect on that population cannot be understated. Then this other, as I explained a little bit, is people for whom we could not find out the risk factors because they either died or refused to talk or had so many that they didn't know. Or included in there is that health workers who have come down with AIDS. Somebody may know better than me, but the last I heard, it's 20 health workers in our country have full-blown AIDS because of needle sticks on the job. There are a lot more with HIV, like 100 maybe with HIV. Does that sound right from people? I have some stuff in here that probably has the data, but anyway, they're included in here.
Mary, you just said that the third cause of HIV is maternal passage. Where did those cases fit?
This is adult. I'm sorry. I should have said adult cases.
Okay.
I will focus on kids tomorrow. Yeah, good point. Okay, let's see where we are. In the United States right now, about 1 in 250 people are estimated to have HIV, which means we have about a person and a half in the village, statistically, who could have HIV. We have 400 people, right? About 1 million people are estimated. Again, it's difficult to know how many might have it. In the United States, there have been 220,000 people diagnosed with AIDS. And all the statistics say things like about 60% of those people have died. I prefer to say about 40% of those people are still living with AIDS. And I learned that from a man with AIDS who presents and says, why do all the stats say how many have died? Why don't they say how many are still alive? It's just a different way to look at the statistics, which I appreciate. In the world, World Health Organization estimates about 10 million people now have HIV. And that by 2000, a mere eight years away, which, you know, it's not like way in the future. 40 million, who says, some other experts say 100 million, some people say 30 million, a lot of people, probably. Currently, we have about 1.7 million people with AIDS in the world, again, that are reported. And it's very difficult to know who all has it and what those statistics all mean. How can you tell if somebody has HIV/AIDS? You can't necessarily. There may well be people in this room who have HIV, who know it or don't. And even people with AIDS, it's very difficult to know. Lots of the folks I've worked with full-blown AIDS have gone back to work and look and feel fine for a period of time before the next episode of illness occurs. It's very difficult to know. And that's important to talk to our teens about, who think they can tell if somebody's sick or if somebody has STDs, sexually transmitted disease of some sort. It's important to know that we can't really tell. Let me talk just for a minute about the patterns of HIV infection in the world. They're changing a little bit, but generally speaking, there are four major patterns of spread of HIV. Pattern one, and maybe what I can do is erase this now. Pattern one is really the epidemic that we've seen in this country and in the Western world. And that is, it started primarily in the late 1970s into the early 80s, was primarily in the gay male community. And that's how it initially spread. So that's the US, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, places like that, pattern one countries. Pattern two countries primarily include those countries in sub-Saharan Africa that was primarily heterosexual contact, And perinatal transmission, very little drug use. I'm sorry, I should have included drug use here. IBDU. And this is heterosexual and perinatal, mother to child. Very little drug use, very little gay male sexual activity documented in the early stages in most of those sub-Saharan African countries. Attitude. And just recently, who has come up with something they sort of refer to, whoops, as pattern 1-2 / 1-2, which is Latin America and the Caribbean. That's primary transmission by homosexual or bisexual folks, but now, in a very short time, its primary transmission is heterosexual. So they've really moved much more quickly into heterosexual transmission, or pattern 2, than most of the Western countries have.
That thought to be because of the higher incidence of bisexual activity?
That's part of it. Some of the cultural differences in whether and how homosexuality is even defined in many Latin American countries and cultures is part of it. And we'll talk about that too later in the week. But there are some cultures that really don't define homosexuality, where men have sex with men on a number of occasions for a number of reasons. Some of them economic, some of them social, cultural, for other reasons, but don't term it homosexuality. So maybe initially the virus got started or spread that way, and then these folks go home with their girlfriends or their wives and have sex with them. And now it's become much more a heterosexual spread, and therefore perinatal also has increased in those countries. Okay, pattern 3 countries really refer to many of the Asian countries, China, Southeast Asia, etc. Also Eastern Europe, Northern Africa, and the Middle East, those general countries in the world. Difficult to really classify them, except to say there are pockets of high-risk activity. Sometimes it's pockets of drug use in certain countries in the Middle East, maybe probably not in the Middle East, certain countries in Southeast Asia. Or places like Thailand, with its high sex industry as part of its economic basis. Or in the Philippines, the hospitality girls along the U.S. Army base, like 80% of them are HIV positive, having sex with U.S. Army personnel, etc. So it's difficult to say, but sort of everybody else that has mixes of all of these and came in fairly late to the epidemic. This is late 80s. Into the early 90s, so the spread is sort of late 70s to mid 80s to now late 80s, early 90s. Does that make sense? It's helpful because I think if we think about the HIV epidemic as one epidemic, it doesn't make sense. It's really a pandemic made up of a lot of small epidemics. Even within countries, the epidemic is different depending on the population and the way things are transmitted.
I was just going to say, I'm in San Francisco, so I see a lot of pattern 1, but I also see a lot of pattern 1, 2, because of the multi-ethnic groupings, the big push, there's a big campaign right now for the Latin communities to alert the women.
Yeah, because of this bisexuality potential. Interesting you mentioned that, too, because even in Minneapolis, our state epidemiologist talks a lot about the number of people he knows of and the number of calls our Minnesota AIDS Project hotline gets from bisexual men who are closeted, who have sex with men, and their wives don't know it, and they come home to the suburbs, have sex with their wives, and the wives get it. I don't know the numbers. I mean, those are kept sort of fairly quiet. But anecdotally, from our epidemiologist, he says, you have no idea how much that goes on. Even in Minnesota, which is sort of majority culture and lots of Scandinavian Protestant religious people. So I don't want to just say it's those other communities that aren't really being honest about bisexuality. It certainly is true in lots of communities. Okay, is there a cure or a vaccine for HIV or AIDS? Wish I could say there was. 3 years ago, I was real optimistic. I said, well, within 5 years, everybody says we'll probably have some sort of vaccine. Difficult, as I mentioned, to develop a vaccine for HIV because it's so changeable and so tricky. And it's a retrovirus, which means it attaches itself within our white blood cells and starts to replicate within that cell. it makes it very difficult to fight that. And in terms of a cure, no cure. AIDS is virtually 100% fatal, and I say virtually because there are people living with AIDS who say to me all the time, don't say it's fatal because I'm alive. You don't know that it's fatal. Now, over time, statistics show that there aren't any people in this country left with full-blown AIDS who were diagnosed with full-blown AIDS in 1980 or 81. Those people have all died. Now, because our treatments are getting better, and that goes into the next question of here, up here about how is it treated, people live longer with full-blown AIDS than they used to. And I think it's important to be as hopeful in light of this dim epidemic, pandemic prospect as we can. It is likely that people with AIDS can live a long time. I've known people living 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years with AIDS. That's full-blown. That's not just the virus. But currently, and certainly in light of what has just come out of the last international conference, people are feeling less and less optimistic about a vaccine in the next few years. With the exception of, was it Max Essex? Somebody at Harvard said, oh, you know, let's not be so gloom and doom. We've got the best minds in the world working on HIV, and something will come of it. And I tend to gravitate there, but I don't want to mislead people and what you read in the paper is what the experts are saying. It's going to be very difficult to come up with a vaccine at this point. So how is AIDS treated? Some of you who are familiar with it or know people who have AIDS, what are they given? Or what are people with HIV virus itself given? What are the common treatments?
AZT.
Okay. What is AZT used for? Why do people get AZT?
There's something for the T cells.
It's a suppressive, isn't it?
Say that,
it suppresses it's a suppressor.
Yeah, it suppresses the replication of the virus in the T cells.
It doesn't kill it, but it slows it down.
That's right, it slows it down. And what we're finding is that the initial sort of great white hope of AZT, which was released in 1987 by the FDA in this country, is that people who've been on it 2 to 3 years find that it's less and less efficacious. It's not working as well to slow it down. However, 2 or 3 years is a lot of time when you're facing with this sort of time bomb that AIDS and HIV feels like. DDI and DDC are two more drugs that were just released in the last year, one in October and one in April or May this year, work on the same principle, try to slow down this replication of HIV. Those are the only three drugs we have currently in the world, and it's really the Western world, to work on HIV. There aren't drugs available in other parts of the world.
What about the stuff they give for the inhalant?
The Contamidine inhalant is used as a prophylaxis against pneumocystis pneumonia, which in this country is the most common disease of AIDS. To get a diagnosis of AIDS, about 60% of the people with AIDS in our country have had pneumocystis, and that's their diagnosis. It's not a garden variety bacterial pneumonia that a lot of us have gotten or will get. Pneumocystis is it's not a fungus, it's the other thing.
Jeez.
No, it's not, or maybe it is a fungus. Well, anyway, it's one of the other weird ones. It's not a bacterial pneumonia. So this inhaled pentamidine is used in a lot of places to prevent pneumocystis pneumonia, and it's done a marvelous job. It has prevented lots of people who previously would get pneumocystis.
When people are being treated for AIDS and it prolongs their life, it also prolongs the time where they can pass it on to somebody else.
That's right.
So I really hope that those who are being treated are being educated as well.
And I'm with you, I certainly hope so. And I suspect any well-meaning and well-trained physician or nurse who prescribes any of these, and AZT is more and more being prescribed for people who are just HIV positive and feel perfectly well, trying to slow down that progression, that they have lots of counseling about their infectivity. I would say from my personal experience that people who have full-blown AIDS, one of the biggest issues for them is the loss of a potential relationship ever again. Most of them see absolutely how infectious they can be to somebody else. There are those few who say, if I'm going to die, I don't care if anybody else will die. But generally speaking, people are well counseled about that risk.
HIV, is it 100%? Are they sure that HIV will lead to AIDS?
99.99%.
Someday down the road, they think that someone will lead to it.
They may find out it's something else, I don't know. But I'm pretty convinced. And
but if you have HIV, you're going to get AIDS.
That question?
Is that what you're saying?
No, that HIV causes AIDS. That
that's
HIV
sure.
is the thing
that's
that causes
not
AIDS.
Positive,
yeah.
Yeah,
I so appreciate that.
You can have HIV and live a life forever.
God willing, you can live 40 years with it. I agree. And that's a very crucial question, because people with AIDS have told me over and over and over, do not say that HIV, if you have HIV, you will get AIDS and you will die. In fact, I see a wonderful example of this. A friend of mine who does a lot of teaching does this.
Does not equal AIDS.
HIV does not equal AIDS, does not equal death. Because a lot of people equate all three of those. Oh my God, he's positive, he's going to die.
Yeah.
And I think that's a major leap of traumatic and dramatic
and
not necessary.
That's where your 1% of physicians are saying there may not be an HIV problem. AIDS may not necessarily directly relate to it.
Well, what I meant by that is that there's a few physicians and researchers who don't think HIV is the causative agent for AIDS.
That's right.
They think it's a different virus of some sort.
Right.
Yeah, so that's part of it. But I also believe with these folks that they need to have hope and they need to have optimism about their chances in life for improvements in treatments and maybe a cure at some point. And I think it's important that we not take that away, we who work in it. Yeah.
When somebody dies on their death certificate, do they put the pneumonia down, or is it they say AIDS?
Different depending on where you live.
Mm-hmm.
It is not required that you put AIDS down in Minnesota. Now, you all can tell me about the other parts of the country. You put down the cause of death, which would be, in that case, pneumocystis pneumonia, mm-hmm. another case, Kaposi's sarcoma, another case, toxoplasmosis. Most of the physicians I work with now will put toxoplasmosis secondary to HIV or something like that. But I don't know that they're not legally required to put AIDS down. How about other places?
If we find a vaccine that can keep AIDS away from the HIV positive people, don't we take a big chance of infecting a lot more people?
Because the people with HIV would be allowed to live with it and
yeah.
not die off.
Yeah.
One way to look at it. The other question that relates to that is if we, meaning the West, or richer pockets of some of the developing world nations, develop any vaccine, either against HIV or against people moving from HIV to AIDS, will it be available to the whole world at a reasonable cost? No, probably not. Right now, most developing world nations have an average of $3.50 per person per year for all health care. And in the United States, it costs an average of $100,000 per person per year with AIDS to take care of them, to treat them. And that's not even every other kinds of thing we do for health care in the United States. So we need to talk about the ethical and moral issues involved with health care around the world, and who gets it, and how is it, and if we even do develop a vaccine, what hope is it for 2/3 of the world, or 3/4 of the world?
Now tell me about pneumocystis pneumonia. I had a friend who died of that,
mm-hmm.
did not have AIDS,
mm-hmm.
didn't have HIV.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that because of the increased AIDS, that pneumocystis pneumonia can increase in the general population? Can you contact
pneumocystis pneumonia?
The disease that is killing an AIDS patient. From an AIDS patient, not necessarily AIDS?
No. No, you can't get it from the AIDS patient, but you can get the same disease from some other reason for immunosuppression.
That's right.
Pneumocystis pneumonia has been around for decades. But
right.
extremely rare, and found in people either who'd undergone some sort of treatment for another cancer that lowered their immune system, or had some other underlying immunodeficiency that was not caused by HIV but was caused for something else. And then this pneumocystis bug got them too. So that is possible to do.
Transplant patients are also under a lot of immunosuppressants and they are frequently susceptible to pneumocystis.
Yeah. good.
So that's not necessarily a fear if there's a certain disease that AIDS patients are getting, that disease would spread?
Right. The only exception I'm aware of right now is TB. And that is, there are two kinds of TB. There's a TB that's airborne and a TB that isn't. And HIV positive people are getting both in increasing numbers, particularly the respiratory spread TB. And that's very scary for healthcare workers, for family members, mm-hmm. for people in inner cities who live in close quarters.
Prisons,
very big issue. Yeah, yeah. So that is the one to be worried about. That's
homeless shelters.
Homeless shelters, yeah.
There's also the resistant TB that doesn't have any treatment at all right now.
Right, which is getting, more and more resistant. Yeah, I've read somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 homeless people with HIV in San Francisco right now. Where are they? They're in the shelters or on the streets. Yeah, so that's difficult. Okay, we have 2 minutes. 2 minutes. I was going to do two more things, and one is to ask folks to think about some of the barriers we currently face to adequate prevention and care and research efforts in HIV/AIDS. I think I'll just mention a few of them, and I'm going to talk about them throughout the week. Those are barriers of denial. It's not my issue, I'm a woman. It's not my issue, I'm Hispanic. It's not my issue, I'm white. I'm not gay, whatever it might be. Invulnerability particularly hits adolescents, just like drunken driving or sex and pregnancy. It's not going to be me. Sexual hang-ups, I maintain, are going to be an issue for a lot of people, not being able to talk about sexuality. Alcohol use, fear, homophobia, hopelessness, poverty and racism in this country and around the world, blaming other people for starting HIV, and issues about sexism. All of those are barriers to doing adequate prevention efforts and care and research efforts. Scott last night talked at Vespers or at Eucharist about beginning with God. I began a little bit with what the ELCA statement says. I'd like people to feel free to take copies of that small piece and read what our church body is about and be thinking throughout the week what it is that we as people of God and as Christian people can do about HIV/AIDS. And I'll let you go. Those of you who want dinner, zip up, please, so they don't ring the bell again. Thanks a lot for coming.